Okay, it is the 15th of September. This is the Privacy in the Digital Age 4th class. And on that topic, I am letting you know that as of this evening, the privacy podcasts and all the PowerPoints are now up on the TWEN site, up through last class. So those of you who may have missed one or more or wish to just go back, they are available for you. Thank you. Oh, a reminder, courtesy of the Office of Student Services, those of you who wish to take your final exam on a computer should have received a memo with the instructions on how to register to do so. Did you? Okay. Please be very cognizant of those deadlines, whatever they are. It's something like 2 weeks from the memo date, something like that. From everything I've heard, there will not be exceptions made. So you missed the deadline, better buy pens. Right. Now, when I say things are changing daily, I mean things are changing, this is this afternoon. All right? 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about children's online privacy protection. And I keep telling you, right? Law changes throughout the notes. Thank goodness it's 2 weeks from now. Because as of this afternoon, the chief regulation underlying the law and compliance with children's privacy issues, sorry about that recording, there have been proposed changes by the Federal Trade Commission. These are only proposed, which means the law right now, or rather the regulations, are still current. But if passed as any prologue, it's likely that some or all of these changes will be made, particularly since these proposed changes, and I will be sending you a link to them, follow a two-year comment period by the FTC. So they've already heard about these ideas, these issues. And in reading, what I'm going to have you do for 2 weeks from now is read these proposed amendments, and it's, or at least skim these proposed amendments. Because as with most things in the CFR, they go on, the explanation, the discussion goes on for about 110 pages, and the proposed language is about 10. It's fairly readable, because it goes through the back and forth and the comments that they've got. So skimming will do, but that will inform our discussion. It wasn't going to until this afternoon. So one really needs to, well, I've made the point. Things are changing. Similarly, I hope many of you saw this earlier this week, given that we're going to talk tonight somewhat about the concept of anonymity. We had an editorial in the New York Times on the 12th by Jeff Rosen about an upcoming case with regard to the scope of privacy in the age of increasingly ubiquitous surveillance technologies like GPS devices and face recognition software. Now, you remember when Warren and Brandeis talked about those GPS devices, right? And the face recognition. So this case, what does it say? U.S. v. Jones. Oh, look, it almost underlines it, the line on the screen like it should, right? Concerns a GPS device that the police, without a valid warrant, placed on the car of a suspected drug dealer in Washington, D.C. The police then tracked his movements for a month and used the information to convict him of conspiracy to sell cocaine. The question before the court is whether this violated the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures of our persons, houses, papers, and effects. And argues this writer, it's imperative that the court says yes, Otherwise, Americans will no longer be able to expect the same degree of anonymity in public places that they have rightfully enjoyed since the founding era. Anonymity in public places? Sort of an odd perception. Just keep that in mind. Right? But we do have, apparently, a split in the circuits. No reasonable person, argued Judge Ginsburg in the District of D.C. Circuit, August 2010, our author cites, no reasonable person expects that his public movements will be tracked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and therefore we do have an expectation of privacy in the whole of our public movements. And you thought penumbra was a confusing concept? Keep that in mind, because happily, for purposes of grading my exams and for you writing the exams, if a case is being heard in November, the likelihood is the law won't change before December 22nd. We probably won't get an opinion before that. And just like the bar exam, if the law changes sometime before December 22nd, I will not hold you responsible on the exam if you cite to your understanding of beforehand and the law as we get a little bit more into government tracking later in the semester. But things change. Okay. And the final piece of news that leads into our discussion today is a brand new, and I mean brand new, social media service called Cloaklet.com. Freedom for everybody. Says Cloaklet, Cloaklet is a secure, anonymous communications medium. Access is free. Send and receive RSA encrypted messages that are secure and anonymous end-to-end. Messaging and file transfer are available in an easy-to-use interface that is free. Premium features include private instant chat, secure file storage, and personal encrypted network. Nope, a notebook. Why? Here's the argument. When it's a matter of security. The freedom that made the internet so great has come under attack. Politicians, lawyers, scammers. It's time we fought back. It has always been possible to communication online. There's, right, that's really giving you a good feeling. They don't speak, you know, their grammar is not so great. I hope their coding is better. It has always been possible to communication online with a high level of security, but now it is easy, it is free, and it's easy. No complex setup, no messy key exchange. Cloaklet protects you. It doesn't know who you're talking to. It doesn't know what who you're talking to. It doesn't know what you're saying. Frankly, it doesn't want to know. Enjoy private communications, making your online conversations anonymous has never been easier. And best of all, it's free to use. How does it work? Why? They answer that question. How does it work? Cloaklet is comprised of three components, each one in a separate physical location. The first component, what we call the light site, is the site you're reading now. It's a publicly accessible website that anybody can visit and read. Here's where you sign up for Cloaklet by creating a free account. Once you have an account on the light side, you can log in. After you log in, you are redirected to the second component, what we call the dark site. Once you arrive at the dark site, you are already anonymous. The dark site doesn't know who you really are. It just lets you create secure anonymous profiles and log in as them. When you log into a secure profile, your computer will start communicating with the third component in Cloaklet, the storage engine. This is where all your encrypted data is stored. The storage engine doesn't know who you really are, and it doesn't know what secure profile you were logged into. The storage engine is, quote, in the cloud, but don't let that worry you. Absolutely everything stored in it is heavily encrypted. These three components are physically and logically separate, so your security and anonymity can be ensured. The light site knows who you really are, but doesn't know anything about how you use Cloaklet. The dark site knows what your secure profile is, but doesn't know who you really are or who you're saying online. The storage engine doesn't know who you really are and doesn't know what your secure profile is. It does know who you're talking to, but it doesn't know what you are saying. I don't know what they're saying.
They have three layers.
That much I got.
So the three layers are not talking to each other, so they're...
Well, clearly, there's some handoff. I guess the idea, and I first saw this on the Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow and Friends blog, boingboing.net, I think it is, and it suggested that the mechanism behind Cloakly, the source code for it has been published so that people can look at it and say, can it do what it said? But ultimately, if I were someone truly dedicated to keeping my communications and my social interactions private and anonymous, this is not the way I would go. Because who's running Cloakly? And we don't know that. We don't know ultimately if the promises it is making are valid. We don't know if it's running some sort of interception during the transmission. For all we know, you know, this is a scam being run by Department of Homeland Security. The idea that we are trusting this outside third party not only to facilitate our communications, but to store them, I'm not all that confident. But I don't know anything about it. I just find it interesting that there is perceived to be a need for this. Why? Why do we need anonymity? Purpose does anonymity serve? When is anonymity a social positive? Let's put it that way. Anonymity can clearly be socially negative. Think ski masks for bank robbers, or Joker masks, or Richard Nixon masks, or whatever they're wearing in your favorite film. Think hostage letters that have been clipped together. Think telephone calls made by prepaid cell phones paid for in cash from kiosks that don't have surveillance cameras. That's used to be called using a payphone. But since there aren't any more, there are many socially negative reasons or socially negative impacts of anonymity and pseudonymity. Someone may be anonymous, have no name, or be pseudonymous, have a fake name, a pen name, etc. But the courts tell us, and I'll cite to a Supreme Court case on the next slide, that in fact there is a right to be anonymous inherent, built into, or rising out of, rather, the First Amendment up to the Constitution. And here we have our First Amendment, which you'd think some of these things were probably worth putting initially, but they ended up in the Bill of Rights. What about these restrictions on Congress suggest to you a right to be anonymous? Where does that come in? Because it does. Where does it come in? Any ideas? Thoughts? No. Chris, any thoughts? Why does this give one the right to be anonymous? Maybe it helps a little bit. Let me ask you the previous question. Why this? Why do we have a First Amendment? What purpose does it serve? What is the commonality amongst these various rites that they've been grouped.
It's rites that there are variations of everything.
Of what? What are these all about? I mean, you have everything from religion to newspapers to coming together, right? To petitioning the government for a redress of grievances. Where's the common thread? Why are these all together? You don't know why we have freedom of speech? Freedom of the press? Why? Why do we have freedom of the press? This is sort of a basic concept. Why do we have a freedom of the press built into our Constitution? What were the founders thinking? What good does a free press do? No? You're okay with suppression of newspapers? You see no problem with that?
No.
What kind of societies don't offer freedom of the press and freedom of speech? Freedom of religion and the freedoms to... Which means what? What don't people have there?
Right.
Rights to criticize, rights to express, rights to dissent. This is about dissent. Our whole country was founded by dissenters. Right. So, okay, yes, that is exactly where we're getting at. But let's think about this. Dissent. The whatever their personal philosophies were, once they got here, that first colony of pilgrims that sailed the ocean blue and landed on Plymouth Rock, or as... we would hear from Anything Goes, Plymouth Rock today would land on them. Musical theater reference for you. They were dissenting, and why did they leave? Why didn't they just stay in England and act as public Puritans? Why not? Why did they feel the need to leave and come across the seas? Afraid. They were being... They could be killed. They could be jailed. Why? Because their faith was not the mainstream faith. Their ideas were not those of the government. And in that society at that time, they felt destination the better part of valor. Go. Leave. Go somewhere where you may express without fear of criticism, you know, being hurt, being imprisoned, being disenfranchised. They left. They came here to dissent. Why was Congress told not to make a law respecting the establishment of a religion? Because once you have an established religion, others are lesser. Prohibiting the free exercise of religion. At that time, that was a pretty biggie. Yeah, that was a pretty big deal. Religion was probably more than anything else the cause of social ills. I don't mean religion per se. Differences in religion. We'll leave that other discussion for, you know, another class. I'll bring in my friend Dave Silverman, who was the atheist who took apart Bill O'Reilly, a college friend of mine. If you ever see that clip, it is phenomenal. But anyway, abridging the freedom of speech. What kind of speech? What kind of speech is this talking about? You guys, haven't most of you at least thought about constitutional law if you haven't taken it yet? Well, taking common law, right? What kind of speech is this really talking about, primarily? What? Political speech. The king is a fig. Right? This wasn't about commercial speech then. This was about speech that could get you into trouble from the government or the press. Why the press? What role could the press serve? What? Informing the people of what? Something other than the official governmental line. The rights of the people peaceably to assemble. You don't have an absolute right to assemble. You don't have the right to be an angry, violent mob. But the right to peaceably assemble. To do what? Potentially protest. To have ideas that aren't mainstream. Or to petition the government for a redress of grievances. We have the right, under our Constitution, to complain. To actually, whether or not we'll be listened to, we have the right to be heard. Or rather, Congress cannot take that right away. All of these, ultimately, are talking about dissent. And while many of them are public, dissent isn't always a safe thing, even when we have a First Amendment. The government has not always been so compliant with these principles. And setting aside the government, other people who aren't subject to First Amendment obligations, in terms of things they're not allowed to do, are not always so good about these sorts of things, not always so tolerant of dissent. Whether it was the founders in the Federalist Papers, whether it's the complaint box at the local workplace, whether it's the tips line that the police set up, where you don't have to identify yourself to call in a tip. Why? Don't the police want to know who you are? Don't they want to go and thank you? Yeah, I'm sure that the people you're tipping, you're dropping the dime on also want to thank you too. Dissent, speech are not always safe. And so, inherent in this idea of enabling, encouraging dissenting opinions, unpopular opinions, whistleblowing, we have whistleblower statutes. Interestingly, and related to what we're talking about, I think you all know what a whistleblower is conceptually, right? An insider who sees a wrong thing and goes and blows the whistle on them, brings it to the attention of the authorities. We have laws in our country that protect whistleblowers. In fact, encourage them. In some circumstances, whistleblowers can get a piece of the action of the fine. A few years ago, I had a friend who's in-house counsel for a software company with offices here in the United States and in France. It was publicly traded in both places. Sarbanes-Oxley was new then, but the securities laws in the United States, which essentially encourage and support the idea of whistleblowing, were in conflict with those in France, where their notion of privacy law permitted an accused to know the identity of the accuser. And my friend, who was trying to come up with an in-house policy for such things, was dealing with the fact that two parts of the company, or at least two offices, had to deal with diametrically opposed views of privacy and anonymity in the securities laws context. It does come up. But this is certainly in the political sense, in the social interaction sense. Without the right to remain anonymous, these aren't always fully available. Freedom of, yes, you are entitled to stand on a soapbox, but you might get a stone thrown at you or 12. You can also put up an anonymous pamphlet and get your message across that way, or now post it online. Sorry about the, it was just, this was a fairly long provision and I wanted to at least get much of it. So this is 1995, McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission. Very interesting, I think, that this issue of speech and anonymity often gets to the Supreme Court in the context of political speech. I mean, makes sense, right? In recent years, we've seen the Citizens United case, which takes, and in Citizens United, you're probably familiar with that case, at least that phrase. It had to do with whether private organizations had protectable rights of free expression, of free speech, free political speech, to the point where it impacted on the money they were collecting and spending on political causes. And ultimately that case in a 5-4 decision held that private entities, whether they were not-for-profits or corporations, were people from the, at least from the perspective of having the right to express themselves politically through donations. But they aren't subject to the same limits, and that has changed a lot of things. But it does come up in that context. And the anonymity piece is that they don't have to disclose their donors. The individuals supporting these organizations with their contributions can remain, legally remain, anonymous. That's where it plays it. So what does the court say, the Supreme Court in 1995? The freedom to publish anonymously extends beyond the literary realm. And it cites a number of cases about the distribution of unsigned handbills. Quote, persecuted sects and groups and sects from time to time throughout history have been able to criticize oppressive practices and laws either anonymously or not at all. And since we want to give people the ability to criticize, protect anonymity. We have a number of citations here. Anonymity thereby provides a way for a writer who may be personally unpopular to ensure that readers will not prejudge her message simply because they do not like its proponent. Therefore, even in the field of political rhetoric, where the identity of a speaker is an important component of many attempts to persuade, the most effective advocates have sometimes opted for anonymity. The specific holding in Cali, which was the case it was referring to above, related to the advocacy of an economic boycott, but the court's reasoning embraced a respected tradition of anonymity in the advocacy of political causes. This tradition is perhaps best exemplified by the secret ballot, the hard-won right to vote one's conscience without fear of retaliation. There it is. Anonymity as an ideal, a protected right. Great. You have a problem?
I have a problem because obviously this is a little, this is as new as it is, it's dated in the sense of, from a digitized perspective, it's easy to maintain the anonymity perhaps of a handbill, but when somebody is putting things on the internet now, it's so difficult to find out perhaps who they are, where they come from, and
it's funny how you say that, because one might argue exactly the opposite.
Yeah, right? But you're placing a larger obligation now on those persons who are transmitting. There's my problem.
And the reason I say it might be the opposite is as follows. If you want to distribute handbills, how does that happen? Some person has to take them from place to place and runs the risk of being physically observed. Physical presence is required. Whereas, and you're handling them with your fingers. So unless you've thought about it and worn gloves, You may have fingerprints on them. And, you know, printing takes space.
And would they hold that person accountable to the extent that that person was handing out anonymous handbills and said, well, Joe actually did these?
You have the right. Remember, First Amendment applies to the government's right to search and seize and investigate. That's what it's all about. It's not a private right of action. So, you have the right to do it. It doesn't mean you'll be successful at it. But you have the inherent right. It doesn't say you have the right to remain anonymous. We do have the right to remain silent, but not anonymous. But in the sense that you may have the right not to be compelled to reveal your identity to the government in certain circumstances because of the right of free speech. Without that right of anonymity, now, again, criminal matters, different story. But in this case of political speech, one may have the right to remain anonymous and free from legal compulsion if you can get away with it, if you can keep from being spotted, if you can keep from being ratted out by someone else. So, on the one hand, tracking someone physically in the real world visibly may be easier than trying to track down the person. And person's a really important issue, right? So let's leave the social media, because that was the beginning of the chapter that I wrote writing as well. So that's the analog, the offline world, this notion of the right to anonymity, but the right to anonymity only works as long as the method of anonymity works. You can only keep your secret identity until someone unmasks you. So how then, since you've taken the opposite approach, Francis, why do you argue that anonymity in the digital age is harder when we're not physically present, when we're not... You don't necessarily get heard, so your voice isn't identified. There are no fingerprints of the physical kind. Why is it easier to remain anonymous in the real world than digitally? That was your argument.
Well, I guess it's 6 1/2 dozen of the other, because conceivably you could have somebody else distribute it for you as well, in the same sense, only through a digital mechanism. So rather than hand somebody, you could conceivably email somebody. So a third party, like you, this entity that you just talked about, what is it? Cloaklet. Cloaklet.
Right. So, on the one hand, but let's assume direct speaking, direct, you know, writing. Not. There's no intermediary. Anonymous in the sense of free of compulsion. Free of being... the government would not be permitted to compel disclosure. That's ultimately what's going on in Citizens United, too. The government... the court says the government may not set rules or enforce rules requiring these political action committees, these super PACs, to reveal the identity of their donors. They may do so voluntarily, but under First Amendment principles, wrote the majority, the government may not create a law that says, thou shalt, thou must, reveal the identities. So anonymity, there are two things here. One is the right of the government to find out, and the other is the ability of someone to find out. And the right remains the same, potentially. The ability is what can change. So on the one hand, the real world may be easier. On the other hand, there are more players involved, and I think that's what you were getting to. There are more intermediaries involved with most online communications. And there may be data, information, in embedded within that the hoped to be anonymous person doesn't think about. And that was really what I was getting to in discussing issues of, in that sort of who sense. Knowing who. How do you find out? How does one try to be anonymous online? Well, one can create a screen name. Where? On a service. How do you sign up for the service? Well, Cloaklet says you sign up one way and then it doesn't tell, you know, one hand doesn't know what. But if you try to be anonymous with an AOL screen name, AOL has some identification of you. If you're paying, there's a payment mechanism that has to be traced. And I do wonder, I mean, where I see the problem with a Cloaklet for the commercial service is, yes, it may be that an individual message, it may be difficult to find it on the system. But were the appropriate government agency to come with the appropriate subpoena, that it, or warrant, right, saying, okay, we've satisfied the requirements, we now have the right to compel you to tell us who these people are. Everybody who's paying, all your paid customers, are there because you have to collect money from them. So there's a record that can be matched to say, people who control these accounts have accounts on Cloaklet. Okay. Once you do that, then you can try to put the pieces together. These two people, oh, it was an instant message. Which two on this list were online at the same time? Oh, look. Interesting. At the same time, those two who were trying to connect to some conspiracy happen to be Cloaklet customers and happen to be online at the same time. Maybe they were both connecting to Cloaklet for instant messages. And then we can maybe see the instant messages within Cloaklet and connected timelines. There's a lot of pieces here. So, unlike online transmissions, do require some level of identification. It may not be a name. It may not be an address, physical address. There's no paid account. It may not be any sort of ongoing record. But it's important to realize that every communication, including with Cloaklet, that goes through the internet is attached to an IP address, a numerical address, and a date and a time. Yeah?
I just wanted to check to see who Cloaklet was, so I went on.
Please.
And they're actually using a domain hosting service to provide the service, so you can't find out who's actually established the site, and it's a $5.95 domain.
No, it's not that you can't. It's that sitting in this room right now, there's no public record of it.
I went online just to see who Cloaklet was.
I understand that.
You can't find out who they are.
Not sitting here. But how can you find out?
Well, right now, I mean, they've made claims. So my question is really more about, they've made certain claims. How do you, since they have a certain entitlement to privacy, and I'm wondering, how do you really figure out whether or not what they're doing is accurate?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Protecting your privacy.
I have not the slightest idea. I would. That's why I said I wouldn't trust them any more than I trusted the FDIC warning I got through my Turo email address that was, you know, a phishing scheme. In the chapter, I raised the example of the anon.pennant.fi. I don't know how you pronounce that. Johan, I think it's Helsingus. Who, in the mid-90s, set up a remailing, an email service that was intended quite publicly to allow people to send and receive email anonymously. He set up this computer. And the way it worked, and I had one of these accounts, it was very cool. It was easy as heck. You know, it's from my incredible criminal enterprise that, of course, I'm talking about while recording. You know, I mean, I just signed up for Cloaklet just to see what it's like. But the way it worked was one registered an email address with anon.pennant.fees database. And in return, received an email address from the anon.pennant.fee domain. To send anonymous email, you would basically send it to the person through anon.pennant.fee. Right? I don't remember how you formatted the sending address, but essentially it was like email address of the recipient at anon.pennant.fee. It would go to Anon. Anon would say, oh, it's coming from this address. I'm going to strip out all the information about from whom it came and replace it with the particular anonymous address that belongs to that email address, and I'm going to send it on. Okay? Person gets it. Oh, it's from 123456 and anon.pennant.fee. I'd like to write back. Reply. It's back to anon.pennant.fee. Oh, okay. That's for 123456. I'm going to forward it to 123456. So the recipient had no information, unless it was in the body of the message, about the sender. It's a great service. It was simple. And how did you know it worked? Because people knew who was running it. They knew how it was being run. He was very public about it. You could go and meet him, one could, if you went to Finland. And his reputation, and it was a smaller community back then, his reputation was good. A lot of this is about reputation management. Whom do you trust? What happened, though? What happened was, in order for that service to work, in order for any of these intermediary services to work, he had to have that domain, that database, to retain those email addresses in order to do the forwarding. And the authorities came to him and said, give. And they said it quite convincingly. And he did, because he had to. He was legally required to do so, and technically he had the information. He had it. Once he turned it over, that service was useless. Same here. They claim anonymity. But because of the way the technology has to work, the ability to remain anonymous, untrackable, let's put it that way, is limited. When all we had were landline telephones, the telephone company, had installed all of them. It knew the physical location of the number because it had put in that line. Unless you then connected to it, you know, stood up on the pole like Oliver Douglas in Green Acres, tapped into it, they knew, the phone company knew where you were, where each caller was. The callers themselves may not have known it, unless they told it, but the phone company knew. Once you get outside of that, you know, with truly personal wireless communications, you know, if you have a ham radio, even a CB radio, it's very difficult to locate people. You have to have good triangulation. But if you're dealing with any service provider, and it's acting as an intermediary, there is some record. Because that's how it works. The way the internet works is, bits of information are basically bundled with the numerical address of the sender and the numerical address of the recipient, and they're sent on their merry way, and they all meet up at the end, come together in the right order. There they are. Those numerical addresses must be there in order for the system to work. So the technology limits the untrackability of the sender, but it only goes, that technology itself only goes so far. What information does an IP address or a telephone number or a car registration give the person who has that number or that other number or that registration? At most, what information can be associated with that number? Car registration. The frequent example that I use all the time on this is you drive through one of these red light cameras. It snaps the license plate. To whom does it send the ticket? The registered owner of the vehicle, not the driver, because it cannot tell. Same is true with the Easy Pass, right? And these cameras that are doing the boothless tolls that are now being put on bridges, they snap a picture of the license plates, and they send a bill, where they automatically bill the car owner, no matter who was driving. Caller ID. What does caller ID tell you? No, it doesn't. It tells you the number and some piece of data. It might be where, but it doesn't tell you where the phone actually is, right? What is the place it gives you? Whatever it's registered as. If I am sitting in California and I call my mom in New Jersey, her Panasonic, home phone reports caller ID for my cell phone as New York. It talks. It's very fancy. I'm not in New York. What's in New York? The address to which that telephone number is associated. If you get a Vonage number or a Skype telephone number, you can have one for anywhere in the world and be anywhere in the world and your phone rings. Same with Google Voice. My Google Voice number is 516-2340-LAW. I was very excited about that. I got 2340-LAW, 516. That will ring whatever device I tell it to ring. 516 is the area code associated with, obviously, older numbers on Long Island. Or is it still just Nassau? How did they do that? I guess they divided it up. 631 became Suffolk, 516. You know why, right, if they keep adding area codes? Because we're running out of numbers. And they have to start reusing the seven digits because there's all these studies that say humans can't remember more than seven digits in a set. That's why we have to keep breaking up phone numbers. New York ran out of 212s. They went to what? 718 first. Well, they went to 718. Then they ran out of 718s. They went to 646. I had the joy of living in Queens, and my number was 718-347-8310. It's not my number anymore. I can tell you that. Then they added a 347 exchange. And I realized, and I was proven right, that anyone in Brooklyn or Queens who forgot to dial the 1 and was dialing 347-8310 and then the next three digits, there was about, 1,000 numbers there, would get me. And as soon as we started getting wrong numbers, we had to have our phone number changed. And they did it. But it was because they chose for their new area code three digits that were already a local exchange. It was stupid, but they did. So that number tells you potential geographical location, and an IP address tells you at most what? What's the first thing that the domain name search was supposed to tell you, Francis? I'm sorry. When you looked up Cloakley,
yes.
What were you trying to find out? And what did you look at for that?
I went to Woods.
Okay. So you were looking for the registered owner of that domain name, and it was casually hidden, right?
I don't know why do you say casually? Because I'm not following.
So in this room, with the tools you have right now, that's as far as you could go. Think like a police officer.
Well, the server,
what's your next step?
The server, the company that's hosting their server,
right,
is allowing them to remain anonymous because the owner of the server is the company that they hired for $6 to host.
Right. So if you want to find out who owns Cloakwood, what do you do? They have the information. What information do they have, the company that issued the domain name?
Presumably they would have who paid them for it.
Right. So then you can at least track the apparent identity of the payer.
Correct.
Unless it was a stolen credit card.
Right? Yeah, presumably if they're not subject to cash,
or they got it, you know, whatever it is. At some level, you may run out of.
They got PayPal.
Right, so PayPal might have the information. And at most, you can track it to often an email address. Then what?
Which is connected to some corporation that might exist in some other country.
Right. What's missing here? With an IP address, so. If you have a domain name, you can maybe find the owner. If you have a communication online, if you have an IP address alone, what do you know? What do you know about it if you just have an IP address? It's like just having a domain name. What do you know? What do you know if you have a telephone number and you're trying to track down whose number it is? Where do you go from there? If you have a 917 number, where do you go from there? What do you first have to figure out?
What 917 area code is.
Right, okay, so fine, you figure it out. It's New York metro area, cellular numbers, mobile numbers. Then what?
The provider.
You find the provider. Good. And then what question do you ask with the appropriate paperwork of the provider? Who's the number registered to when?
At the time of that phone.
Right. Now, telephone numbers, generally speaking, don't change so quickly. But you go through your parents' phone book. I don't recommend it because it's probably in the nightstand, and I really don't recommend that. Do not go through your parents' nightstands. You go through, or your college phone book, and maybe college is a while ago, and maybe you have some area codes, and you just dial a number. What's the likelihood that, well, first of all, the number's probably still a good number, unless you had, you know, went to college a really long time ago. What's the likelihood that it's the same person? Pretty small. People move. But telephone numbers need to get recycled. It takes a while, but they do. IP addresses are very much the same. In some cases, IP addresses are permanently, or quote-unquote permanently assigned to a particular user, a particular device. As we move from the current IP version 4 to IP version 6, and the number of potential addresses approaches the number of molecules in the universe or some ridiculously large number of possibles, IP addresses will likely be assigned permanently to devices. But we're not there yet. So right now, an IP address, just like a telephone number, is associated now with a particular provider. But, you know, what could we do now with our cell phone numbers when we switch providers? Take them with us. So my number started as a variety. Actually, my number started as a 9X number. I've had it a while. Then it became a Bell Atlantic number because they merged. Then it became a Verizon number because they merged some more. And then I switched over to Sprint for about 8 months for some project I was working on. Took the number with me. So if during that time someone needed to find me, track my number, went to Verizon and said, "Who is this?" Well, it's not ours. Go down the street. Sprint, they have it. And then back again. IP addresses, generally speaking, don't transfer like that. The way it works, just mechanically, and it's important to know this from a legal, why am I doing all stupid technology stuff? Because as lawyers, we need to know these things. And I can tell you a number of stories where you actually have to do some of these forensics or know how they work. IP addresses are allocated in bunches to service providers. They're running out. They just allocated the last few bunches. That's why we have to switch over to this new system. So one goes to the Aaron.net, sort of like Whois, but it's almost not for the domain names, but the numbers. So which provider has this? Oh, okay, it's Verizon. It's Fios. It's Comcast. It's Cablevision. It's Touro College Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, whomever. Then what? So you now know which provider it is. What other piece of information must you have in order to better identify the person who used that IP address in a particular way? What do you need to know? Yes, but generally speaking, it's like asking who the question of, you know, whose phone number. What do you need to know? It's like those phone numbers in your old college book. What makes those numbers no longer good? Why? Why is it not the same as it was in your book? What's changed? No, the person, same person. What has changed between the writing of that book and the and
time?
Time hasn't changed. Time has passed. It's no longer then, it's now. The way IP addresses can be allocated is like the way telephone numbers get allocated, but sped up about a million times. Many service providers have more IP addresses than they have subscribers. You know, it's like Zipcar has many more subscribers than it does vehicles. It has enough vehicles for the subscribers, the expected use. Not every single Zipcar subscriber is going to be driving at the same moment. So they have expected usage, they have enough cars, so they have satisfied customers. Same with IP addresses. The way most internet service providers have worked historically is when one logs in, connects to it, the provider takes the digital equivalent of taking the next IP address off the shelf, sends it out, assigns it to that account for that session. At the end of the session, that IP address gets returned to the stack. That's how it worked. They're called dynamic IP addresses. Just like telephone numbers get assigned, and usually it's, you know, last in, last out. So that now, if you have most of these high-speed connections that we have at home now, you'll see, oh, you'll pay more for a static IP address. That doesn't mean that there's, you know, you touch it and you get a shock. Static in the sense of non-changing. Why do you want a static IP address? So that if you're running some sort of a service where people want to connect back to you, like a web server or an email server on a regular basis, and not have to look up where you are at that moment, having a number that stays is important. We at Touro College, Jacob D. Fuchsberg Law Center, our building has a static IP address so that it's a consistent two-way connection that is just simpler that way. Anybody know the telephone number of the Hotel Pennsylvania? I was just writing about this. I don't know if you saw the very latest updates as it gets to drop. By the way, do you guys realize what I did? I don't know if you got that. The way I linked the book, you're seeing it in real time. It's linked to my Dropbox, where this cloud-based server. So if I save a word now, and you check on Twin 2 minutes from now, so you can keep me honest. You can see where I am. So this afternoon, I was working on a section. So anybody know the telephone number of the Hotel Pennsylvania? It's very famous. there was a song. The Glenn Miller Orchestra.
8675.
No, that was Tommy Two Tone, right. Some business, I was listening to a radio station recently, and some company in New Jersey, that's its phone number. I'm like, but I guess it makes sense, it's really memorable. But no, Pennsylvania 65,000. So I think it's a Glenn Miller Orchestra or something. It's one of those big band era. Pennsylvania 6, what does that mean, Pennsylvania 6, 5,000? Right. It was, PA 6 was the sixth exchange in the area of Penn Station, number 5,000. So you'd pick up the operator, get me Pennsylvania 6, 5,000. And that was the number. And then it became, I got this wrong, so I'm going to look at it. Oh, sorry, it's not Penn PA, it's PE. Get that right. I got that wrong when I was looking it up. PE. It's not the state abbreviation. Murray Hill was another one. So PE6 5000 became 736 5000. And now, today, the Hotel Pennsylvania, which has probably gone to 12 different owners, go to its website. You know what the number is? 1-212-736-5000. It still has Pennsylvania 6 5000. That number actually tells you where it is, too, in a way. So, but telephone numbers, by and large, don't stay that current. You have to know when. You just get lucky with Pennsylvania 6 5000. It's still the same business. IP addresses, you have to know when, too, but it's really fast because they just keep circulating. And if you don't have a static IP address, if you don't have a static phone number for the last 70 years, even if you have, so I would say it, so you could pay extra to your internet service provider, get a static IP address. These days, most people with high-speed home connections, just so you know, essentially have static IP addresses. You can't be certain of them, but as long as you're cable modem stays connected, or your Fios thingy, it keeps the same IP address. So it's longer term, but at some point, if you power it down, it might go away and change. You need to know the when, and you need to know it very, very exactly. Not just what day, not just what, but to the second. And if your clock doesn't agree with the internet service provider's clock, you better do the conversion first.
But it can differ really for a lot of corporations, because a lot of corporations are going to be on the static IP address, depending where your desk is connected to that data.
Well, see, then you've got the, so let's, we're following the trail. And I think it's important to understand this from a legal perspective. The effectiveness of anonymity. We have this notion of anonymity, but making it happen is harder than one might think. So, great, we have a service provider. We have an IP address. We have a date and an exact time, and we have whatever legal documents we need under the law we looked at last class, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, because asking a provider for non-content information, like who owns this account, has certain procedural requirements. We need to give you this document. We need to get this court order, whatever the circumstances are. You can look them up. Fine. Provider tells you this account was assigned this IP address at this date. Then what? Then what? What do you need to figure out?
Time.
We have the time. What don't you know? What doesn't the, you know, the local highway department know or care about when it snaps that red light picture?
Who's driving?
Who's driving? Those laws don't count. Doesn't matter. When you're talking about civil liability, personal civil liability, or even more so, criminal liability, knowing the account holder is probably not going to be enough. And then you get to issues like corporations or law schools. Every one of us, when we get online here at Turo, from this building, out to the internet, we have the exact same shared IP address. The world sees us as one. Then how does it work? How is it that I don't get your webpage? At least I don't think I do. It's because essentially, we have this router sitting between us and the world. And inside our network, each of your computers, when you connect to the wireless network, is given a local IP address. And when you say, when your computer sends out a request, the computer would like to see this web page, that request goes to our router. The router says, okay, I'm going to send that request out to the world. It's going to come back. I'm going to keep in mind which local computer, which computer in the building wanted that piece of information, and I'm going to in turn ship it back to you. We're all sharing the same connection. So if one of you decides in your infinite wisdom that this would be a wonderful facility from which to download child pornography between classes, you laugh. I'm certain at least, I don't know about child porn, it probably has happened sometime. Right? To the world, we've all done it. No. They trace the IP address because that kind of thing can be spotted, you know, whether CloakNet or Cloak, whatever they are, or everybody else, the IP addresses have to be seen in order for the communication to happen. They trace it back to this building. Then what? It's the same exercise. Okay, Touro College, Jacob D. Fuchsberg, this communication at this exact moment from this site back to you contained child pornography. Where did it go? And in theory, we can look at the logs of our router and say, okay, that communication came from the outside and was routed to that computer. We have enough for a prosecution yet, folks? We have enough to sue for damages yet? Why not? Who was using it? The most, and this is where you do have a potential for digital anonymity, even with IP addresses and service provider records, if they're kept, and internal network records, if they're kept. The most one can identify, at best, is the particular account or the particular machine. And the rest is good old-fashioned circumstantial evidence.
KCN.
What? Or eyewitnesses. Yeah, I was standing right behind this person to whom that computer happens to belong at that moment, or there was a surveillance camera, or, you know, that camera had to be turned sideways. So turn it sideways, and I can control it from here. It's actually kind of cool. You guys don't think about it. There's a camera here. Dean could be watching us. Just thought you'd like to know. Hold on. System tools. I don't have great controls from this, but it's also remotely controllable. Yes. And if I can do this well enough, and I have Zoom too. Hold on. It's a little bit, getting the focus is not always so easy. Hold on, let's see. I think it's meant to keep professors from playing with it, because if you hold it down long enough, it just swings. So it takes a lot of patience to do this right. Okay, there's a screen. Okay, there's somebody's computer. Now we're going to go down. Can we go down and then zoom? We're zooming in. Let's see if we can see what's there.
It's chipped.
Okay, oops, there it goes. Yeah, these are actually remotely controllable, which is kind of a joy. Stop that. Anyway, you get the idea. That's a camera, folks.
What is it there
for? It's there so that we can do video conferencing. That's what it's there for. It doesn't happen all that often, but we do. Or we can record guest lectures and things like that without having to wheel a camera. Not every room has them, but a lot of them do. Oh, stop that already. Stop swinging around. You get the idea. Anyway, so. You need that camera. You need a witness. There's a case that I cited to in the chapter. Shaquille O'Neal, he of the rather tallness and media love, and I think he can play basketball too, was doing a ride-along with police, because he was. I don't know if he was studying for an acting role or he was just there. And as an aside, where could he sit in, like, you know, Crown Vic? I don't know which seat they put him in. Today, by the way, was the last day ever for the production of the Ford Crown Victoria. So car seat. Aficionados raise a very poor mileage tier. And there's this, you know, very well-publicized, Shaquille was going on a ride-along for a child porn bust. And they broke into the house and they got the guy. And it turns out that the IP address was misidentified. That wasn't the guy. It happens all the time. I don't know if you guys saw it last week. It was last Thursday in our elevators. There was a case, child porn case, and I think in the federal courts. Anybody know any about this? I think one of our adjuncts is litigating it. Not the defendant, mind you. It was about, what's the defense? It's a child porn, online child porn case. Where's the defense? The defense apparently is, from what I've heard, that it was the neighbor. I mean, it was the neighbor. It's a wireless network. All they could track is to the wireless router. And which computer was on the wireless router can't be determined publicly. So they're trying to get, you know, Joe from 123 Smith Street. And Joe is saying, no, yes, my account, but it wasn't I. My neighbor uses my wireless account. Talk about evidentiary problems. That's as far as you can go. So we do have the potential for digital anonymity, even in a situation where the finished site has to give up the IP address, or these cloak people have to give up an IP address, and the internet service provider. And that assumes, by the way, that the IP address has been kept and logged. They may not keep logs, in which case you've got to watch it happening. But at most, so when your client comes to you, as my client has, and says, this fraud happened on our website. We have an IP address. Now what? We had a client who said someone purchased, it was not physical goods, but it was some sort of service, and didn't pay us. And now is claiming, person whose payment account it was, claimed it wasn't they never did this, they don't know anything about it, we shouldn't charge them. Client had an IP address, and what we were helping the client do is A, understand the mechanics, we being the law firm, of what you can do with an IP address. They had the time, they had the date, they had the IP address, they could get to the provider. We filed subpoenas with the provider to give us the identity. Ultimately, the goal was to match the name associated with the payment method with the name associated with the IP address, to make it much harder for that person who controlled the payment method to argue it was not he. Now, it could have been some kid. But at least you couldn't say, wasn't us, nothing to do with us, we don't know anything about it, didn't come from us. Yes, it came from your computer. That's demonstrable. After that, legally, flip side is, if your client wants to be anonymous online, wouldn't it be cool, lawyer? Is it okay, lawyer, if all of us get together and sign on to whichever rating site and we post, you know, fake bad reviews of our competitors? Isn't that free speech? Well, no. It's a commercial tort. But they can't find us, right? We use fake names. Except all the IP addresses belong to your company. Kind of hard to prove. The people would be difficult. So yet, that's why I go through this exercise, to understand in terms of the privacy of digital communications generally and the preservation of anonymity, the way the technology works makes it both easier, but ultimately you can only get a certain way, a certain distance in to identify the individual. So if you just have to identify the car owner, great, or the house owner, or the party responsible for the payment, fine. If you need the person, you can only go so far with technology. Questions? Okay. So where does this come up? Well, a lot of times people want to be anonymous or pseudonymous, use a pseudonym in social media. There is a reason why, I'm sure nobody here would know this, but the standard shorthand for flirting in chat rooms, particularly in public AOL-type chat rooms, is ASL. You know what ASL stands for? Age, sex, location. How old are you? What gender are you? Approximately where are you in case we either want to meet up or don't? Somebody tweeted this morning that, I was chatting online with this 14-year-old girl and she told me, she said she's an undercover cop. My, what a great accomplishment for such a young kid. So, the issue of who are you, really, in social media is both a cultural one. Some media encourage or at least permit pseudonyms. Others prohibit it. Google Plus has a real names policy, which is undergoing all sorts of privacy scrutiny. You're supposed to give your real name. People say, that's not fair. We don't want to have to do that in order just to use the social media. So the who is questionable. The where, these issues, the social media service providers may or might not have access to that information. And so might the people on the other end. If you were calling the Pennsylvania Hotel, you may not know of its street address, but back in the day when there were only wired phones, if it was Pennsylvania 65,000, you knew it was somewhere in the vicinity of Pennsylvania Station, New York City. Any number you could tell within a certain, you know. So those kinds of issues are inherent in social media. What I wanted to spend the rest of tonight talking about is the other kind. The risks inherent beyond just identity. One is unintentional disclosure of information. Privacy in the sense of confidentiality. Not only who you are. Oh, you mean I wasn't supposed to identify myself? I wasn't supposed to go on these location services because I'm in the witness protection program? Oops. Or like LeVar Burton, the television star. I once heard him talking about how he was on Twitter and he tweeted, you know, he was on his way to, I think, Toronto, and tweeted to his followers, any good bars? You know, I'm going to Toronto, any good places to hang out? And he got there and 500 people were there to wait, welcome him. And his wife freaked out. So that kind of stuff can unintentionally, you know, disclose. But also the stuff that one may be contractually obligated not to disclose. There's privacy risks in terms of embarrassment and stigma. We talked a little bit about health privacy. We'll come back to it again. Disclosing things, pictures. See, for example, former Congressman Anthony Weiner, who private messaged and then didn't. And he was certainly disclosing himself and unclothing, clothed, you know, right? Yeah, it's a whole other discussion. Or who was the actress yesterday who's whatever famous Hollywood type actress? What, Scarlett Johansson? It was all the rage yesterday. Secret nude pictures were on some website, and she's now calling the FBI. Someone said, if you don't want nude pictures to be shown, don't take nude pictures. Misuse of information by sites and others. Privacy policies are great. But if you disclose information in a public sphere and it's captured, then you have no more control over it. Security breaches through social media too. Passwords, fake social media sites, and so on. Personal injury and loss. How can you get hurt or lose something physical because of social media? Well, let's talk about the example of location-based services. Anyone here a user? Foursquare? You don't always know where I am, but sometimes this was how I was able to tell the first years that a particular first year used this salon. She, Foursquare, you know what Foursquare is? Or Gowalla? Or Facebook Places? Right. So now, since so many of our devices with which we communicate have GPS circuitry embedded, every cell phone, whether you have a mapping program, whether you have a screen, your cell phone has a GPS chip. It has to, by law. So that if you call 911, you're having an emergency and you can't tell them where you are, your phone can. Every cell phone at least reports to the 911 service. Computers have GPS chips. GPSs have communication services. Your car, right? What is it? OnStar, how may I help you? Skynet, how may I help you? So a lot of these services are powered by this notion of, we've gone full circle, or great circle, right? Mapping. Geography used to not matter on the internet. It used to be borderless, locationless. There's a classic case that I love teaching in my cyber law class about the site called Voyeur Dorm. And yes, it's exactly what it sounds like. It was and is a website, sort of like Big Brother without the alleged plot. It's a website where there's a residence, a house in Tampa, Florida, with cameras. And an astonishing number of young, scantily clad women stay in the house, shower in the house, lounge in the house, and people pay and watch them. It's obviously fake, but the city of Tampa, a few years ago, tried to shut down Voyeur Dorm. And the argument was, you're in a residential location. You're not zoned for... forget commercial activity, burlesque, you know, strip club. It's a house in the middle of a street, in the middle of a suburb of Tampa, Florida. And ultimately, the circuit court rejected the idea. And the idea, the rejection was based on the wonderful notion, and it made sense here, that zoning laws are specifically based on physical geography. Has to do with the character of the neighborhood, right? The location. The court held that given the fact that there was no parking lot, there was no signage, there was no light leakage, you know, the windows were closed, effectively, this site did not exist in Tampa, Florida for zoning purposes. It existed in cyberspace. Location didn't matter, because it had no impact on the outside world. And zoning laws, which are peculiarly impact on location laws, now, you might have had tax law that could have applied, something else, but zoning, the way it was written. So it used to not matter. You used the first customer query that one of my, back when I was doing work for advertising agencies, and one of our agency clients built a website for, I think it was Volvo North America. And if I recall correctly, the first query came in from Tanzania. You know, you're a retailer, you're selling all over the world. You're hearing from people all over. Geography didn't matter, and you couldn't know. And even if you thought it was coming from AOL, someone could literally have plugged into a telephone line anywhere in the world, dialed up AOL, so that it would have looked like they were coming from Virginia, even though they were in Italy. Geography didn't matter and was largely unknowable. But now it isn't. As we saw in that in the slide I showed you at first, GPS technology being able to track, particularly when you connect it to social media, is changing that, is imposing geographical knowledge. Also, to a certain extent, you can tell by, there's a rough database of IP addresses, particularly the ones like ours where the building is known location. That's why when you're overseas and you try to log into a service like Netflix, which is only licensed for domestic streaming, you'll be told, sorry, you're not allowed, or if you try the BBC from here, sorry, that content is not permitted to go to you, the country you're in right now. How do they know? Because the IP address is roughly known. When you look at a site that says, meet new hot whatever's in Islip, New York. Say, so how do you know I was in Islip, New York? Because that's where your IP address is associated. But if you're coming in through the virtual private network from Alaska, it's still going to think you're in Islip, New York. It's very important. But that geographical knowledge is beginning to be imposed, particularly with these social media services. Foursquare, Gowalla, there are others. Again, it's embedded into Facebook now. So some of these existing tools add geolocation, like Facebook Places. And why? Because the idea of social media is your grouping. And even though social media began as a way to find like-minded, like-thinking, like-doing people when your town didn't have them, now one of the ways people group is by where they are. For the flash mobs. Let's all get to X place at X time and raise our hands and say, wee! Because they can. Or, you know, I'm at this concert. How many other people I'm connected with on this service are at the same concert sharing this experience? Sometimes, you know, a business will give you a coupon. Do you know? Maybe you don't. That if you check in, if you indicate your location on Foursquare at the Touro College Law School bookstore five times, you get a free Red Bull. It's true. I did it, and then I found out I'm not sure that they're kosher, so I couldn't take it. But yeah, you check in five times at the for our bookstore, you get a free Red Bull. Why? Why are businesses doing that? To encourage people to show up in real world. That's how these real world stores are fighting online commerce, by giving benefits to actually showing up. The person who comes most often is the mayor. Be the mayor of Radio Shack. And if you're the mayor of your local Radio Shack, you might get 20% off your order. You know? But they're not always such a good idea. Exhibit A. This is where you can get hurt. PleaseRobMe.com. This was a real website. I'm not sure if it's still live. But, whoops. Wrong button, try that again. You know what, I'm not going to take the time. Please Rob Me was sort of an exercise in demonstrating the problem. And since a lot of these services, as they're tied in, so people who check in on Foursquare, it shows up on Twitter or on Facebook. And you could search all of those check-ins. And you could determine which of those people has just said he or she is not at home. Or is in a hotel. I'm stunned. I mean, I do this on occasion, but I think about it. And I know it. I know my lock. I know, you know, if I were someplace, I wouldn't say, hi, I'm here, and, you know, my child is at home. But, like, we're in the amusement park. Fine. You know what? They want to find who I am, break into my house. The precious things are with me on the ride. But Steve Wozniak, you know, the billionaire co-founder of Apple Computer, he's a big Foursquare user. I follow him on Twitter, and he tells me everywhere he is, which hotel, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, I want to rob a billionaire. I just found one. Please Rob Me was essentially tracking every publicly announced and said, these people aren't at home. You could rob them, either go find them or rob their home. It was a demonstration of the idea of these public things. So other ways to think about in terms of privacy, not just of identity, but of with whom you're speaking. Great example, May 2009 for Business Week. Ad agency was bringing a potential client in. Client said, oh, I hear you're talking to our competitors, pitching them too. Ad agency, how did you know that? Well, because someone from the agency had mentioned we're talking to X other company on Twitter. We're following it. So practice point is we as lawyers, our clients are thinking about keeping information confidential, whether internally or imposing that obligation. This is one way it can leak out casually. This person wasn't trying to reveal corporate secrets. Just mention, oh, you know, I met X from X company at work today. And that's all it took. Another tech companies that should know better. The Wall Street Journal, when Apple was first releasing the iPad, it gave out demo units. Under strict, they had to be clipped to a desk. Apple should know, right? Not brought to German pubs. But someone at the Journal tweeted that he was using the device. Apple got upset. Someone I know of, another tech journalist, posted a photo. Just a photo. Publicly and talked about it on Twitter. And someone looked at the photo. And, you know, photos, digital photos now, have embedded within them information about the camera that took them. You know this? It's the properties. If you look at a digital photo and look at its properties or get info on a Mac, it'll tell you the date if the camera had a calendar, the place if it had a GPS, and the camera brand and the resolution. And it turned out this photo posted by this tech journalist said Palm Pre 5.5 megapixels, except none of the currently released Palm Pres had cameras of 5 megapixels. And everybody suddenly knew this journalist had the next device as a prototype. He didn't even mention it. The photo gave it away. What about when there are privacy laws about disclosure? This happened about 2 years ago. It was exactly 2 years ago. I'm looking at September 15th, 2009, story from ZDNet, I think. Right? Hospital, a blogger went by ambulance to Robert Packer Hospital after she suffered a serious spinal fracture. The story takes an unusual turn because Cortez said Twitter helped her escape from the clutches of hospital staff whom she claims tried to intimidate and coerce her into accepted unnecessary surgery. This patient is tweeting out about her bad experience, the malpractice that's being, you know, done to her. And what is the hospital able to do? Nothing. Nothing. Because it is subject to the HIPAA rules, which prohibit it from discussing transmitting patient health information electronically. It cannot speak because it has privacy laws that apply to it that keep it from responding. I mean, yes, it could bring some sort of defamation action, but the hospital could not respond. So we've talked about these ideas. Determining who, when, and the when is required largely to figure out the who, but also when it can be relevant on its own front. There have been cases here in the New York area in the last few years, people accused of crimes, in-person crimes, who were able to say, I was on Facebook at that time, here are my Facebook entries, here's the picture I posted at that time, and I have enough evidence to prove that person wasn't the person who was, in fact, accused of the crime. It's, you know, these things happen. Where we see, whether it's disclosed explicitly, implicitly, or part of the service, and the what? The behavior tracking. I'm using an iPad. Oops. I took a picture with this camera. That behavior was supposed to have been kept confidential because it indicated the NDA-covered device. Right? All these things are inherently disclosable, discoverable within the context of these social media, sometimes knowingly, sometimes without anyone realizing it, sometimes accidentally. And in thinking about how privacy law and policy and practice impacts on the use of social media, we have to remember these issues. I asked you to take a look at these policies, and we're sort of running out of time. Was there anything that sort of, Facebook's changes every other day, right? Twitter can tell you what it will disclose or not, so can Facebook, so can LinkedIn, but ultimately, what don't those privacy policies cover? The way that the services enable you or someone using your device to disclose without these services doing anything. But they do have, they collect this information. Certainly Foursquare, interestingly, not only does it have a privacy policy, but it summarizes it, privacy 101. That's very risky as a lawyer, because if it's inaccurate, if it says in nice simple terms it's doing something that it really isn't, you've got a problem. You have to make sure if you're going to summarize, it tracks exactly. It's also worth looking, and like I say, I'll post these slides, looking at what companies do about social media use, seeing where their policies are. And I will leave you tonight with this tweet from this evening citing Conan O'Brien. I just kind of like that. As I was preparing for class, this pops up. It's a great line. And that says everything you need to know about social media. All right? I know I owe you an assignment for next week. Certainly go back and look at what the FTC has done. We're going to be talking about consumer privacy and really bringing in a lot of things. I guess the other immediate assignment, and I'll email this, is I can say go buy something, but go look at the privacy policies of online retailers. Not just Amazon. That's the obvious one. Go pick two online retailers that you're willing to discuss, having at least looked at the site. We're not going to assume you bought from them. Take a look at what they say, remembering what we've talked about in terms of the information they absolutely have to have in order to sell you something. All right? Any questions? Good. I'll send you some other things. I'm not going to bombard you with that. Have a good evening. Sorry? Was that about texting all night while sitting in class? A number of tweets from law students today about, I should have done this, right? About, you know, I'm sitting in class tweeting. I'm like, yeah.